Oh, hello. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there.
Hi. And DJ Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy.
Oh, and academic. I forgot the academic part.
Yeah, let's just leave with that. I don't DJ enough to have that be the first thing. So
every week we start off the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week I want you guys to tell me what's something that you love by an artist that you loathe. For instance, I absolutely love the movie Spanking the Monkey and Flirting with Disaster, but every time I hear something about David O. Russell, the human being, I am either saddened or disgusted.
Same.
Him, you know, getting in fist fights with extras on Three Kings is bad enough, but when you add in, like, groping his trans niece.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Oh, you didn't hear about that? Ooh.
It was while they
Sony
were making...
email.
Because I was going to say punching an extra is kind of amusing, but
but I draw the line.
I draw the line at
incestual molestation.
Nieces.
Also, artistically, I feel like he's just turned. Like, Silver Linings Playbook was sort of the worst that a movie like that can be, and Spanking the Monkey and Flirting with Disaster really were some of the best, edgiest, weirdest romantic comedies I have ever seen. One was a romantic comedy about a son and a mother. That's pretty intense. Winner, what's something that you love by an artist you loathe?
I like the song Forever a lot, and I hate Chris Brown. I just absolutely despise him. I despised him before it's not even alleged, that before he beat up Rihanna, and then I really was disgusted by him. And I'm more disgusted by his fandom. The amount of people that love him in spite of all these things he keeps doing. So that's like the only song, the only one that if it'll come on at the club or if it comes on in the car, I just like the way it goes. And they all remember that wedding where they had the dance that went with
it? Yeah.
That was really sweet. I shed a tear, but I just can't stand him. I think he's just so obnoxious.
I was going to say that I think the hardest assignment I ever had as a critic was reviewing the album of his that came out right after that whole incident.
Yeah.
Where it was like, okay, I'm going to listen to this and try to be fair. But at the same time, I just find this person reprehensible.
Yeah.
Mainly because, like, even in that record, he starts off, like, the first or second song with this kind of, like, proud moment about what happened. Like, he has this line about something like, when the way that Ike hit Tina,
yeah,
it hit me or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just like, really, you're going to do that? You're going to start off this whole thing that way.
He makes so much money still. And his fans are aggressive.
Margaret, when you're writing a review like that, where do you draw the line? Do you mention it? Is it your job to, talk us through that?
Well, I did mention it because he mentioned it. In a way, yeah. It was like, once he puts it in the lyrics, it's completely fair game. But if he hadn't, it would have been tough. I would have definitely mentioned something about it because especially writing for a newspaper, it's like that was news. That was the last time he made news. So it's like you couldn't not mention it. And it for somebody like me and so many other listeners, it colored what he was doing, what he was saying. Everything about his artistry got, you know, tainted in one way or another from that. So I think, I couldn't pretend that I wasn't going to notice that or that I was going to try to ignore it. So I just completely worked with it in the review.
What's your thing you love by an artist you loathe?
Well, wait. First, I want to ask you where you stand on I Heart Huckabees.
Yeah.
Oh, I am emphatically pro I Heart Huckabees. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
It's magical. I don't know that it's a good movie, but I loved watching it.
Yes, that's kind of the way I feel too. Like I wouldn't stand behind it as a
or
great
American
piece of
Hustle.
Art. But American Hustle. See, enjoy it that much.
I liked it.
I thought it was thin. Tina Fey calling it Explosion at the Wig Factory really got a lot of what my problem with that movie was. It's like, look, famous cool people pretending to be uncool.
Christian Bell was perfect.
Well, to answer your question, I do not like Aaron Sorkin 90% of the time. Like, all the TV shows that he's been celebrated for and championed for, from Sports Night to West Wing to Newsroom, I just have never liked any of those shows. I find his dialogue style really grating and just false. And too many times the characters are jerks that I have no interest in. But for whatever reason, I think Social Network was like the right person for mm-hmm. him to tell the, like, that was the right person for him to grab onto and to like flesh out that myth. Yeah. And the fact that he was dealing with a real person, Mark Zuckerberg, he had to exercise some kind of restraint. He had to find that within himself to summon. And I think it was good for him.
It's also Aaron Sorkin, who's our Patty Chayefsky, our guy who's writing pages of chatty, chatty dialogue, like being handed over to David Fincher, who like is all about, who hates words. Mm-hmm. And the end result is a movie that's like somewhere in between.
It's true. Also, I love that Amy Schumer sketch that she did with, I'm forgetting his name, the guy from Sports Night, where they did a great parody.
Is it Josh Charles?
Of 12 Angry Men.
Oh, God. I can't remember his name. Maybe it'll come to me.
It's Josh Charles, I think, wasn't it?
I think so. Like the main guy is Sports Night.
Josh Charles. It definitely wasn't the other little hottie, so it was Josh Charles.
Yeah, he's an attractive man. They're like in a McDonald's. Like they have all this intense, like heated West Wing style dialogue within a McDonald's type place. It was hilarious.
Oliver, what's your thing you love by an artist you loathe?
It would be Bad Boys 2 by director Michael Bay. And I mean, I was trying to think of if there's any other Michael Bay movie that I would remotely even ride for that I just do not think commits all the worst sins of, especially this Transformer series, which are some of the worst action films I've ever seen. As someone who likes the genre, I just can't stand the CGI orgy fest that are those films. But Bad Boys 2, I went and saw it in the theater with a friend, and at that time, it was probably the most fun I'd had in the movie theater in years. And, you know, the movie has a lot of problems with it, but for whatever reason, the idea that you would have a scene on a bridge where someone's throwing cars off of a car carrier, kind of a brilliant set piece.
It's also used a lot in since then, and people don't give it credit.
With people throwing cars at other cars.
Oh, my God. It's been in, like, a Mission Impossible.
Yeah, Furious 7.
I think it was in, a lot of that. I mean, right. It's kind of, it was also, that soundtrack was just so on point.
Yeah. And Will Smith and Martin Lawrence have a really good working chemistry together. I mean, everything that you would want out of that particular genre really worked in that particular film, but I ride for absolutely nothing else that Bay's ever put out. But I love Bad Boys 2.
Oliver, was Tia Leone in Bad Boys 2?
No. And Bad Boys 1 was not a great film.
No.
And somehow Bad Boys 2 managed to transcend. I mean, that this would
more
be
difficult to do. More explosions,
duh. It's not even explosions, though.
Maybe. I just want to think about the sentence, Bad Boys 1 was not a good film.
Yeah. Because so many people will disagree with you. That was a really good movie.
It wasn't like a terrible film, you know. Yeah. It wasn't Transformers, but or The Island, or, my God, what else has Bay put out in recent years? But no.
Did he do The Happening?
No, that was M. Night Shyamalan. John.
That guy.
With Marky Mark,
where it's the trees.
The trees are killing us.
The trees are killing us. It's the trees.
Yeah.
It's the trees. Remember, it was the trees? Just like in War of the Worlds, it was the air. It was the molecules in the air. It was chlorophyll being absorbed by the sky, coming back and shitting on us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
M. Night Shyamalan, it seemed like a good idea for him to have a shtick, right? Like, when we got to that second movie, where it was like, oh, the twists just keep on a coming. Then we saw The Village. Thanks again to K-Play's Base and the Max Fun Reddit for that question. You can give us your own answers on the Max Fun Reddit or the Pop Rocket Facebook group. Coming up on this week's show, we've all been to the movies for these first weekends of blockbusters. And we'll be reporting back on the blockbusters we saw. Plus, we'll each share our own latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver Wang.
I was going to go with Veep, which I was going to describe as the most delightfully profane show since Deadwood, maybe even better than Deadwood when it comes to the use of profanity. But that's a very close one.
That is setting the bar high.
But I'm going to extend off of last week and go. I'm still going to talk NBA, and I'm going to talk about the little B curse that apparently has now afflicted James Harden. And for people who don't follow the world of Barry hip hop and the world of basketball, Little B is a rapper out of Berkeley. He's insanely prolific. He's known as the Based God. And Kevin Durant a couple years ago basically tweeted that he didn't understand why Little B was popular. And Little B cursed him and said, "You will never win a title after insulting me." And then the Thunder have been a mess of injuries and a failed opportunity since then, and people will always invoke the power of Little B. Now, this past week, Little B accused James Harden of the Houston Rockets of stealing. When Harden does a really good move on the court, he does this cooking motion with his arm, like he's stirring the pot. And Little B says that he basically took that from him, and that Harden might be cursed. And anyone who would have watched last week's game, or this week's game, I guess, where Harden basically lost the ball with a chance to win the game in game two against the Warriors, it just created 1,000 Little B James Harden memes on social media. It's been kind of amazing. If the Rockets lose this series, which they look like they will be, the Little B will now have taken down 2 NBA superstars. So shouts out to the base god out there in Berkeley.
Does he give psychic readings?
Yes. I want to know.
Want to know my future.
I'm so excited to have the worlds of hip hop and the NBA cross over with witchcraft. This gives me real hope. Yes. For what the craft,
it
the
is
craft
the unholy,
could be.
It is the unholy trinity right there. Hip hop, NBA, and witchcraft.
I'm down.
Winner, what are you all about this week?
Not to make it a very special episode of Pop Rocket, but the Duggar family.
Oh, not that kind of special.
Not that kind of special. This is like way after school special, almost a TV movie on Lifetime. They have the nerve to have put this show on TLC, allegedly knowing about Joshua, the son. Now, if you don't know the show, it's about Jim, Bob, and Michelle, and they have like 95 kids, and they're all start with the letter J, and they're fundamentalist Christians, and they also hate gay people, and they also are totally fucking ridiculous. Now, this show's been on for years through every birth, and the older girls have started to have children of their own and procreate and get their own specials. Well, it turns out Joshua, the son, he admitted it. He molested the sisters. He molested people in the family, and he molested some of the sisters. So listen, I don't even want to get into the ramifications of how that happened, why that happened, what the surroundings were. If you knowingly put a show on, and if people around you in your community are knowingly protecting someone and not allowing them to be brought to justice, for the victims to find a way to heal, then there's – what kind of person are you? So even if we're having a discussion or debate, like TLC took the show off the air today but won't say canceled – call the show fucking canceled, because there's no way in America are we – that is the final thing. Like, if we start just making it okay for child molesters to have television shows and reap benefits and have advertisers be okay with that, then I'm done. I will literally throw my TV out. I will go full network. I will take over KTLA Morning News.
Whoa.
And
you hear that, KTLA?
You hear that, KTLA? And you're right down the street, closest – you know, you're an ABC affiliate. You get it. I don't have a problem with – reality shows, but when something like this is real and it's not dealt with immediately, I have a huge problem with it. It's disgusting. And that's, I'm just 100% against this. So I'm not all about it. I'm totally anti it. And the people supporting them on Facebook saying, God sometimes has, you know, we do things bad and it's okay.
Or Mike Huckabee's statement about sometimes good people do bad things.
This is not that.
This is different.
This is different. Well, go ahead.
I mean, it's sort of like, I do actually think that there is something valuable to having this story as a coda to a show that really was about an approach to sex and sexuality. A show that was very much about a construction of religion and gender and how they relate to each other. And sort of shows, hey, if you raise kids in a fucked up world where they're not allowed to express their sexuality in any like reasonable, normal way, screwed up things are going to end up happening. And I really feel like that was a difficult and dangerous show that was sort of presenting a world where it is a woman's obligation to be subservient to her man and exist only to procreate. Presenting that as a charming little domestic comedy.
I don't want to hear any like Muzak intros or outros to their sequences. I just want people to be telling the truth and for other people who are more responsible to oversee these situations. If you have a company and you've even heard or even there's been a suggestion that he's touched someone or done something that's abusive, you need to address that and you need to cut your losses and you need to stop presenting that to the world. There's just some things, maybe I appreciate freedom of speech as much as the next person, but I have a huge problem with child abuse and sexual abuse. I just find that reprehensible and I don't think it's fair to promote it. And I feel bad for the people on Facebook who are talking about it in this way. It's uncomfortable.
Why did it come out now?
You know what? I got to tell you, it sounds like there's a hater in the crew. So whoever was just completely disgusted. Well, no, somebody hated because it was buried. The sheriff knew about it. The priest knew about it. The family knew about it. Allegedly, TLC knew about it. People knew about it and had discussed it openly. His wife knew about it. So why did it come out? Somebody said, you know what? Done. They just had a huge special, just had a huge marathon. They just had a CBS in their home doing a special on them. It was somebody said, no, this is too far.
Well, do you think that this is going to change TLC's programming now? Now that they've had this happen and the Honey Boo Boo thing?
What should they have? Do they not have cloaked in scandal?
No, exactly. They had the same thing with John and Kate. Like, John and Kate, that was the most ridiculous thing. When you give Midwestern, corn-fed fools money and then they just get on and start acting any old kind of way. This is the problem. And this is why I can go on a tangent about this all day long, but I'm very disgusted by it.
It's Wild defends the Kardashians and the Real Housewives because they are gross within parameters, and we know the kind of gross that they are.
We can take their gross, yeah.
We can take their gross. A little rehab, a little, you know, extra boobage.
A little splash of plastic surgery.
Yeah,
you know.
I'm fine with touching
your sister.
Nobody's
telling us that they're wholesome. Like, everybody knows that they are gross. I this weekend am all about a gigantic article. Oh, Margaret, you haven't gone yet. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My thing is just a gigantic article in Slate by Brian Lauder called What Was Gay? That was basically a response to the just astounding number of articles we've been getting from gay and non-gay authors, a surprising number from non-gay authors that are basically predicting the death of the gayborhood, predicting the death of the gay bar, predicting the death of gay culture, as though us being able to get married in 37 states means that we no longer have... will be or should be a distinctive culture. And Brian's article is, it's enormous. It's not hard to get through. But at the end, he breaks down gay culture in like a functional analysis that basically says that like close reading of other people, which he calls, he refers to as cruising, like drag and the use of appearance both to mask ourselves and like to blend in and to make ourselves distinctive, queeniness and playing with sort of like concepts of hierarchy and family and a notion that we are family to each other, that these are the building blocks of all gay culture. And as part of a group that like doesn't have like our feminine mystique, it was like really wonderful. Like it was a great first step towards having one of those works that really defines what goes into what is essential about our culture.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Did you happen to read that Alison Bechdel interview in the New York Times Magazine where she actually talks about the same thing? The interviewer asks her, like, are you sad that some element of gay culture is no longer... is basically like now out and exposed and no longer this sort of secret underground thing because gay culture just keeps getting more and more acceptance and more sort of put out in the sunlight. And she did say that she really laments that fact that she doesn't, you know, in some ways the acceptance comes with some kind of loss as well, like some kind of loss of like a real kind of like secret culture that was, I think, like fun and tantalizing to be part of.
But is it more important to be sort of protected or not let the evolution happen?
Margaret, my joke on the subject is essentially that being gay used to be really hard. It used to be Harvard. Now it's Cal State Dominguez Hills.
Oh, that's we'll, rude.
Ouch. Cal State, do not take offense, graduates.
But essentially, you know, there was something really awesome and ridiculous about what gay culture was, and it is changing. But I think, like, express homosexuality that can stand up to sunlight is both better for the world and for the psychology of gay people. Like, you know, having to act like spies all the time had some adventure to it, and it like led to a well-textured culture, but it also, you know, we all saw Far From Heaven. fucked you up.
But wait a second, you didn't answer my question.
Uh-huh. What's your question?
My question is it more important to have that protected, or is it more important for it to naturally evolve and include others?
Oh, I mean, I think it absolutely has to evolve and include others, because gay culture has been defined by co-option of other people's culture, because we essentially were not allowed to have a culture until adulthood, and so had to deal with being gay through largely picking up scraps of women's culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that as things go on, we will have more stuff that is for us, that 13-year-olds of any sexual orientation will be exposed to it more and be able to understand themselves in the context of it. You know, it is a culture of oppression, like so many are. And with that comes good and bad. And I think this concept that all of it should be scrapped because it is a culture of oppression is ridiculous. It won't be. But you're right, Winner, that it is something that needs to grow and evolve.
I want to be down where the boys are. Come on.
Winter, the ancient alliance between black women and gay men is a thing more powerful than any think piece.
It's like Loki's scepter.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
Well, we don't have to go deep into this, but Mad Men, I want to talk a little bit about the finale. I just want to put it out there that I thought the ending with Don was really great. And for me, like a really satisfying conclusion that just went to show that his character essentially stayed the same, that he, you know, went through yet another revolution of like pain and depression and hating himself. And then it goes on the bender, like kind of hooks up with the younger lady. And then ends up at this place, I mean, Esalen, which how great was that, just as like a Californian to see that place on TV. And, you know, goes through all of his usual like self-brutalizations, you know, hugs this man who's basically like a stand-in for him in some ways, but then also the man that he's probably like kicked around a ton at a place, you know, at one of his advertising agencies at McCann or Sterling, like, whatever, that's exactly the guy that he would have ignored. But in this moment, he's hugging him. And then the moment where he comes up with the Coke commercial in his mind and that little smile spreads across his face, I just thought it was all really perfect.
So I haven't watched Mad Men for the past couple of seasons. So, like, did you get a solid understanding of why this world of advertising was how it fit together with this dude who was a well of lies and really sort of an interesting caricature of white heterosexual masculinity in the mid-20th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, Don Draper was this like fantasy male on the surface. Like, he's so good looking. He had the perfect career. He had the perfect family. But then the more you would dig into that man, it was the appearances weren't all what they seemed. And he was actually quite distraught and quite like had this like
just
schism of identity. Yeah. And I think that in a way that's like an American story, that kind of schism of identity of like never really being settled in one way or another, because so many Americans are pulled between all sorts of different identities, and even masculinity itself, like inhabiting that identity, like what, you know, we see even Don's interpretation of what it means to be a man change throughout the series. And I think all of that plays into advertising in terms of like what advertising is on the surface, what like the glossy finish of products and the way those are sold. But then the product is something actually different.
It was also interesting how at the end of the show they talked about, well, the reviews after the fact talked about, you know, the episode was called Person to Person, and the important conversations he had at the end, everybody sort of had their narratives tied up and done into little bows, more or less. But they talked about how he had these important pivotal conversations with the three most important women in his life.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about that. I also didn't think about the fact that they filmed the Coke ad in Italy, which was Betty's favorite place.
Oh, right.
So there's a lot of, and then the girl at the retreat who had the pigtails was, you know, in the commercial. So there were so many things that Matthew Weiner, he's just so good at, like, subtly throwing things in there that you don't even catch. And then some, he's been very gracious and pulled a lot of it together.
And I think there was, choosing Coke was a perfect choice because it's not like Polaroid or something that's already sort of in the past.
Right.
Like, Coke is still this extremely dominant force in our culture.
And it's all marketing. Coke is an identification with marketing.
Yes.
For me, the best thing about the 7 years of Mad Men was watching the glorious arc of America and January Jones and just falling in love with how beautiful and seemingly talented this woman was, then that SNL and us being disgusted with ourselves.
No, it was the Bobby Flay pickup from the accident scene. I don't know many married men other than my father who would pick me up immediately from an accident scene.
If you guys had to guess, because I always find it interesting after a show like this, like, who's going to make it onto other shows from that cast?
Oh.
If you had to guess who's still going to have a healthy acting career, who would you say?
It's definitely not that guy with the glasses that's a jackass. What's his name?
John Hamm will do fine.
Yeah.
I don't think it will be leading man work. I think him establishing himself as a fun guy in supporting roles is good. I think Elizabeth Moss will get television vehicles.
I do too, because she already had a
top of the
substantial
lake,
career
fantastic.
Before that. Yeah.
She'll do fine.
January Jones, no?
I don't know. I feel like she's one that's tricky because she is, I mean, I don't recognize her from anything else but that.
I feel like Vincent Kartheiser.
He'll do fine, I think.
He'll do fine. And
what about Joan?
You know?
Oh, Joan's on the show that I wrote for that, like, comes on in like a month.
Oh, good.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
So you're keeping her on the air.
I'm mostly
you're doing your part, guy.
I just want more Talia Shire. Talia Balsam. Talia Balsam showing up for like her 5 episodes. Always amazing.
But also, what's the one, the French one? We need to do better research before we get into this. The French one who played.
Megan?
No, I'm done with her. She's with her.
I like her.
Megan's mom. What's. Julia, thank you. Julia Ormond. Julia Ormond is she's so great in that role. And then she ends up being married to Ryan. Just you got to watch it, guys. It's just so, it was very perfect. It was very perfect.
I need to watch those last 2 seasons. Oliver, any big calls on the cast of Mad Men?
I've only ever seen 2 episodes. Sorry. There's a lot of television out there. I can't be watching all of it. I'm too busy watching basketball for the group here because none of y'all watch it. So
the Grizzlies are in Mad Men.
The Grizzlies are in Mad Men. There's a grizzly in it.
You're listening to Pop Rocket, a show about pop culture, which I suppose does technically include sports, Oliver. We'll be right back to talk about summer blockbusters after this.
Hey, Max Fun listeners, I'm Dave Holmes. And if you've been missing my show, International Waters, you've been missing this.
I am aroused, but I have zero idea.
Really?
I'm really, yeah, sorry.
Name a British, name a British food lady.
Name a British food lady, Julia Childs.
I'm afraid I can't accept
that's
that.
Not.
No, it's not Julia. No.
British. Come on, you must know your British food ladies.
International Waters, a panel show where U.S. and U.K. comedians battle for pop culture supremacy. Subscribe right now on iTunes or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio. Who's in the studio? Well, I'm not in the studio. I'm in New York. Who's in the studio?
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang,
and the girls are getting drunk.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
They turnt. You guys, it is summer blockbuster season. Like we have some real contenders this time. This is not a sad summer where we just have like one lame Marvel superhero movie. We have a superhero movie with all of the superheroes. And we've got a Mad Max movie that men's rights activists hate. But all of those got beaten at the box office this past weekend by a movie about girls singing and doing choreography.
why do you say it like it. That?
It's an exciting, exciting summer. Margaret, you. Oh, and Oliver, you guys have both seen Mad Max, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Also, by the way, for people listening, there are going to be spoilers in this. We're talking about movies. So if you do not want to know about things that happen in these movies, maybe you should listen to this later after you have seen the movies. But this Mad Max was a attempt at a boldly feminist step. It is about, it's more about Charlize Theron as Imperator Furiosa trying to get a bunch of women, essentially the harem of this big bad guy, away from his terrible, terrible citadel, off to this feminist
the green
paradise.
Place. The green place.
Or the all
mothers
place.
Where all ladies and plants live.
And you know, the big story is that George Miller got Eve Ensler to come and be a consultant on the movie. And there's been a lot of back and forth about whether this is an actual, like, boldly feminist action film or whether it is men painting the notion of feminism on an action film of the sort we have seen many times before.
Wait,
Oliver,
are people actually arguing the latter? I've yet to see anyone suggest that it's, I mean, you can debate the degrees of the success as a feminist film, but I have not heard anyone actually make the latter argument that it's a faux feminist film.
Oh, I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go in then.
Unpack us, Margaret.
Well, I was just going to say, In These Times had a complete takedown of the movie being a feminist vehicle. Like, their take was like, no, absolutely not. If this is feminist, then we've got a long way to go, baby, because there's still, you know, the four women that come out as the sex slaves are still basically like your Victoria's Secret / L'Oreal hair dye, you know, panorama of women, right? Like, and I mean, I do understand that criticism to a certain extent, that it's didn't exactly like shock me on a feminist level. I wasn't like, oh my God, this is really like making waves. But I appreciated a lot of the gestures that did happen in the movie.
The film reminded me a lot of the Coen brothers' True Grit, with but an even more stylized sort of statement. Oliver is looking very skeptical.
I'm just trying to pair True Grit on one hand, you know, with Mad Max Fury Road on the other.
True Grit was about a woman going into the wilderness, mm-hmm. having right. to defend herself, no longer having the protections of society, and ending up with which is
you just ruined True
Grit. I assumed it was the same thing happened in the second one as the first one. So,
but,
okay.
Yes. I mean, can I say though that I still feel like Mad Max, even though it did have some interesting female characters, I still feel like the focus is on men. I mean, we know way more about those war boys than we ever know about those sex slaves. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that to me just fundamentally, and the fact that the older women warriors that come in don't come in until 2/3 the way through, which isn't really like blowing the roof open and showing me female characters for that long.
They were such a striking divergence from what women look like in movies that it was for me like...
In
action movies. Like, just the naked lady who is up on top of the, like, tower as bait, when she got down and it was a face that was scarred and weathered, was like, I thought that there was something bold about, bold but maybe not that substantial about... Uh-huh. Presenting these figures and saying, hey, women aren't just this one thing you think they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like those characters, but my beef with it is that they came in so late, and then pretty much 10 minutes later, most of them were killed off. And
yeah.
So to me, it just feels like if you really want to make a feminist movie, move those characters way up to the beginning.
They're like the Ewoks. Is that what you're trying to say?
Pretty much.
The
I mean,
She-walks.
Even one of them has a medicine bag, which I did appreciate. But I just I just felt like it was a little like on purely those characters, the older ladies, was like too little, too late. And then as far as Furiosa goes, I do think I mean, I think Charlize Theron was amazing in the movie. I think she was this one kind of oddly realistic anchor in the movie. Like, the men were actually quite cartoonish. You know, even Tom Hardy, who I think was great as well, kind of was channeling this, like, Gary Oldman-esque, like, cartoonish performance. It was a strange performance.
A lot of mumbling.
Yeah. Well,
one thing I thought was, I mean, I honestly didn't feel like there was that much Mad Max in this Mad Max movie.
No, that's one complaint by the MRA crowd, yes.
But the one thing I thought was nice about it, it was focused on men, was that it did kind of make the argument that, as Ginsburg has said, women's liberation is men's liberation, and sort of taking you through the arc of the war boy Nux and sort of saying this deeply hierarchical, masculine, aggressive world it sort of chews up and spits out all people.
Yes.
I thought that was, if it opens up some 14-year-old boys' eyes, maybe that's not a terrible thing.
Yeah, agreed, for sure. I mean, it does show that patriarchy is a system. Like, that kind of patriarchy, the complete aggressive, out-of-control version, is bad for everyone.
Who destroyed the world?
But, right, wait, who destroyed the world?
Does this follow the same thread, yes, that all the other ones do? So is this an official sequel?
Miller's been cagey about him. It's both a reboot insofar as it doesn't have Gibson.
I think he called it a revisiting.
Right. I mean, it's basically visiting the world of Mad Max, so there's still some kind of linear consistency here, but it's not as if it takes place 35 years after Thunderdome, for example.
Just remember Thunderdome and Tina Turner.
She was amazing.
But right. That I didn't see it, but it sounds good. I
mean, Margaret. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Oliver.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that the film is, again, is it like the perfect feminist vehicle? No. Does it do much better than pretty much any other action film that Hollywood typically turns out? Yes. But the bar for that's very low.
So low.
But I would say even compared to that low bar, I think it sets a pretty new high standard for what could be possible, which is to say that Mad Max isn't that centered. There are really, with the other exception of the Nicholas Holt war boy, whose character I still don't quite understand, even though he gets some really great lines in, mostly like
Oliver.
It's a lovely day.
I understand him and could fix him.
Yes.
So you're the redhead of the tribe, is what you're saying. You're the ginger spice of the sex slaves.
But to me, this was a film that was largely about a critique of patriarchy with really strong female characters. And again, where Mad Max really plays kind of this backup secondary role. Again, not perfect, but, you know, to use that old cliche of not letting perfect be the enemy of good, I thought this was a very, very good movie. And it was a very, very good movie in terms of a movie in which women are being centered in the film itself. And, you know, not to sort of bury the lead on this, but the other thing about the film, too, is it's such a triumph of visual action execution in terms of practical effects. It uses CGI sparingly, but when it does it extremely well. I don't know if Mark, you saw the film in 3D or not, but with the scene where they go into the sandstorm is incredible.
Really?
Like in the big screen in 3D. And just the level of execution as an action film is so much better than anything that I've seen in recent years.
I have to say, though, that I could have done with about 15% more story. Because I don't know the Mad Max franchise. Like, I haven't seen any of the Mad Max movies previously. So I came into this pretty blind, actually. And I didn't really understand what was happening for, like, a good 20 minutes. And I didn't ever understand why Furiosa was even doing what she was doing.
Yeah.
Like, there was never motivation explained for that.
I just love that we're going back to an action franchise from a point in time when nuclear weapons destroyed us and not rising tides. Like, it was just so rooted in our cliches of what the apocalypse looks like.
Totally.
In 1980, that it's just that movie, and there was something a little bit nostalgic about it. It may not have been a perfect feminist movie, but it came very close to being a perfect badass movie.
Yes.
Like, like that we were not so dependent on animation and that we got actual things slamming into actual other things.
Oh, boys.
And, you know, the bass guitar that shot flames.
Oh, my God, the guitar. Every time that happened, I cracked up when that showed up. It was just so ridiculous. I mean, I loved it. It was just so cheesy.
It's meant to be
incredible.
Over the top, right.
I mean, that's the moment where I was like, oh, this is basically a Nine Inch Nails video meets Burning Man.
There you go.
But Oliver, it was taken down at the box office by a little film by the name of Pitch Perfect 2. Mm-hmm. We are subverting all stereotypes because, well, some stereotypes, because the only people who have seen Pitch Perfect 2 here are the men, you and me.
You're so proud of that.
I am in no way proud of going to the theater to see Pitch Perfect 2. I like a nice light comedy, but I didn't hugely love the first one. I kind of adored this one. Oliver, what were your thoughts?
Well, so I went to see it partially because I really actually liked the first one. I think as a sort of kind of teen meets sports filmy cliche genre film, it actually was really effective. You know, Andra Kendrick is mostly watchable. And it just,
I agree with you on that.
She's so great.
It just worked. I think Pitch Perfect worked really, really well. But the main reason I went to go see the sequel is because my 10-year-old daughter loves Pitch Perfect. And she's learned more about music and pop music through that film than probably I've been able to teach her, which might make me question my parenting abilities. But in any case, this is the first film in her lifetime where she was bugging us about knowing when the release date was and wanting to go see it. So we all went as a family. We went to ArcLight. This is how committed, Guy, I was to going to see this film. We bought tickets ahead of time on ArcLight. We went to see it. The problem I think I had with Pitch Perfect 2, besides its inherent flaws, is that earlier that afternoon, I went to go see Mad Max Fury Road. And you cannot go from Mad Max to Pitch Perfect 2.
That's a harsh transition.
It just is not going to work.
Yeah.
Especially, the thing I didn't like about the second film, apart from sort of the super thinness of the story, I thought the casual racism in it really bugged the crap out of me. And the first film took some cheap shots, but it's like they tripled down on that in this film with the Guatemalan character whose only purpose there is to speak with an accent and talk about like the time she had dysentery. and the fat jokes came, I thought, just as much as the first one. I just find that. It felt mean-spirited. It didn't feel funny at all.
Okay. A problem of this script, and God knows I love a light comedy. I like a female-centered comedy. And if either of those things can win a weekend, I'm happy. But the Pitch Perfect films do have a nasty habit of attributing one type of joke to each of the characters and just having that character hit that joke over and over again. Mm. You cannot hear the Asian girl.
Right.
It was annoying. I also had a pretty big problem with David Cross swanning in as a pretty bad gay stereotype, never labeled as gay. But it's like
terrible.
Our beloved like heterosexual male comics think that that's a real funny choice to make with a cameo. And I'm maybe not so in on it, but I will defend Rebel Wilson and the fat jokes. I kind of loved, as a fat American, I loved her ownership of it and her agency. Like, that this is somebody who got a love interest, who got a cute love interest, and who was weird the whole way through. It's the sort of thing we have seen from fat, goofy guys in comedies for so long, that seeing it with a woman and having her not be a ridiculous booby prize was... I thought empowering. That scene
you
with
think
her.
Bumper was not a, okay. All right, you like Bumper a lot more than I did in that case.
Adam Devine is really cute.
He's really cute.
He's
really cute.
Did you feel like they had any chemistry? And also, this also goes for Hailee Steinfeld's character with Benji. I felt like none of the romantic couplings, with the exception of Jesse and Becca from the first film, there was just zero chemistry between them. So I never believed them for an instant as a couple. I could believe the Bellas as a world-class a cappella group, that was easy to believe. I could believe that there is a German group out there that sings with sort of like German mechanical precision. I could not believe either of those couples as being couples because there was no spark at all between them. And I don't know if that's a failure of acting or failure of scripting, but it annoyed me when they were on screen because every time they popped up, I'm like, I don't get this. I don't buy this at all.
It was really mechanical. It didn't make a lot of sense. Keegan-Michael Key was pretty amazing as...
He was great.
As Anna Kendrick's boss. And then I just have to tell you guys, Margaret and Winner, are you at all aware of who Flula Borg is?
No.
No.
Okay, he's like a German YouTube star who is in this movie and gets a huge amount of screen time.
Oh, is he the German male singing lead?
Exactly.
Okay.
Oh my God.
I did a show with him like that he was hosting like a couple of months ago. And I kept assuming that this person was doing a character because he was such a gross caricature of that German guy that I was like, yeah, this is a funny bit, but you're going to turn this off. We're in the green room right now.
Like the SNL Dieter kind of sketch or?
No, but just hyper masculine and but
yes.
Still.
No, but that's really who he is.
Yes, just like cheekbony, like.
I gotta give it up to him for being a YouTube star.
It sounds kind of
slightly hot. He's a YouTube star and is in one of the. I mean, like, he's just opened the gates for everyone else now. So I actually gotta give it up to him.
Which gates would those be for?
For YouTubers to transition into film.
Oh, okay.
You know?
But he has a skill set. Like, we gave Grace.
A lot of them do too.
We gave Grace Helbig a TV show and we saw what happened.
And it's doing well.
Oh, is it?
Yes. Apparently, it's doing well.
Oh, God, that's terrible. It's a real
bad
show.
Basically, if a quarter of her audience that regularly watches her videos were tuned into the show, she got a really good rate of retention and conversion because she got about 276,300,000 people.
Wait, who are you talking about?
Grace Helbig. Oh, we're on a different topic, I guess.
Sorry.
Wait, you were going to say something, though, Oliver. You were going to say something about the German?
About the German female lead who was in a great show out of Denmark called Borgen, which I think PBS carried for a few episodes.
Can
which
we
is
talk about Age of Ultron now, Oliver?
Jesus Christ.
Winter.
No.
Winter.
Oliver, tell us about the Danish girl.
No, she plays a reporter on this Danish political thriller called Borgen, which is one of the best television shows of the last 10 years I've seen.
Oh, yes. People told me that I would like that because I like
so it's funny
shows.
To see her showing up, number one, playing a German, number two, singing, and singing fairly decently because it's very much unlike her character on the show. But so, you like the sequel better than the first film. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Oddly, yes. And I feel like it was just, it may be just because I saw it in the movie theater and gave it my full attention. But I always, Pitch Perfect, the first one, didn't quite hold together for me. And I know so many people love it so completely. Mm. And I feel like that may just be a failure on my watching style.
What I'll say is I definitely did not like the sequel as much as the first film. But I will say that whatever my discontents were with the film, the closing number, which of course is the big closing a cappella number, totally won me over. Like I left feeling, oh wow, that I really enjoyed that part of it. So
it was a solid song. It was no Cups though.
No, nothing is Cups.
Can I ask you guys what you think of this scandal about Rebel Wilson making up her age?
Oh,
what's the scandal exactly?
She's been saying she's 29, but I guess she's really 35.
Which is so. What is so wrong about being 35?
How's that a scandal?
I don't know.
Like, who cares? 6 years.
That's what I say too. Who cares? But it was like it's been out there on like the tabloids and whatever.
It's how Los Angeles works. I tried to slice 4 years off of my age really hard at the beginning of my career, and it just didn't take. Too many of the people I did College Quiz Bowl with were ready to edit my Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm. Jerks.
Winter Mitchell. You and I both saw Avengers Age of Ultron.
Finally, something I can chime in on. Thanks, everyone, for your thorough reviews of those other movies.
I've found so many of the Marvel movies to be just a little bit lackluster. A lot of solid Bs there. And this movie was glorious and gorgeous and exciting. If you guys listen, people are listening at home, I really encourage you to listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour where they talk about it because Glenn Weldon breaks down the way that this movie.
Yeah.
Yes, they're not our competition. There are beloved
cousins. Go listen to a more notable podcast. But what we're about to talk about right now.
Well, it would be wrong for me. It would be wrong for me to talk about this without attributing it to Glenn.
Just but like, it, plagiarize it. No fact checks our episodes, man. Shit.
Colin's Oliver, not here.
You're supposed to be the soul of our academic respectability.
I teach at a CSU, so apparently it's not very hard.
Oh my God.
The doors basically just blew off, ladies and gentlemen. That's the
ouch of the year.
Joss Whedon like slows down the camera and gives you these like rich full scenes where everybody's doing something.
Yeah, I love that.
Margaret and I are looking at each other because we're actually super surprised that you guy like this film. But
yeah,
okay.
We don't get it.
Okay,
why?
I don't know.
Because it looks boring.
Yeah, yeah.
Age of Ultron. Not first of all, it is a boring movie, okay?
I
was literally sitting, I don't know what he's talking about, because I'm sitting here thinking to myself, Guy, I thought we were supposed to be on the same team here. The movie was infinitely more boring than Iron Man 2, had a little bit more of heart into the schmaltz area than Iron Man 3. And there was a lot of uselessness going on where somebody just had to be in a scene just to justify being in a scene. And like somebody's manager said, you need 5 seconds more screen time.
There was a fair amount of that. There was a fair amount of, all right, Thor, why don't you go leave for half of the movie?
Right. He swings totally bounced. I got to go.
What you guys are missing here, the key element that you're missing, is that when I walked out of that theater, all I could think about is, if I were 11 years old, I would have spent the next 2 weeks being Scarlet Witch. Like,
just in any scenario? Every scenario.
Every scenario. Like, I would have just spent all of my time trying to cast weird red spells at things.
Tell me about Scarlet Witch, and is she close to the Red Witch in Game of Thrones?
No, Scarlet Witch is one of the Olsons, Lizzie Olson.
Oh,
and who was the one that played
She's
her brother, Aaron, that's married to the woman, the director?
Oh, is he? I don't know.
Knows all these things.
Well, I do know all these things, but we're in the middle, and I've had two shots of vodka, so things are getting a little blurry. He was really terrible. Oh. He's usually pretty good, and then I didn't realize how terrible of an actor he just was.
He plays Quicksilver.
He plays Quicksilver, and he also plays Kick-Ass.
Okay.
Look, bantery play between Iron Man and Captain America, very, very good, very, very charming. I thought that the film sort of made an argument about America being about collaboration and sort of made some interesting points about the less powerful characters being necessary.
No. I didn't feel that.
I guess
all.
That means they gave Hawkeye more to do. That's a takeaway from what
Thank you.
From what Guy's
they
saying
gave
right
Hawkeye
now.
A lot more to do. They even gave him a whole background. They gave him a wife who's pregnant.
It was stupid. His background was ridiculous
and
stupid.
Was ridiculous. I was distracted by the fact that Chris Evans didn't use a stunt double this time, a butt double either. And then I also felt like Tony.
His ass is so weirdly flat. Winter, let's talk about
this. Let's talk about this, because his ass wasn't flat in Captain America and it wasn't flat in the Avengers. So then all of a sudden it's like, flat, and I'm like, dude, and you're extra pasty, and I love you, so just
he's so hot in so many ways.
I'm gonna go
see
the film just to check out Evans's ass.
But then Robert Downey Jr. is like my favorite, and even I felt like he was a little too Tony Starkish, wasn't in the suit enough. I need to see full suit in action with the poses and the stances. Not getting that. I'm really tired of Don Cheadle always needing to be in a suit. You need to take a seat back.
I forgot that he's in there.
Yeah, like
he wasn't in the first Avengers.
I mean, that is one thing about these movies, is the number of people that they need to get in is so problematic. Also, the fun little line you get about why Gwyneth Paltrow and Natalie Portman aren't there.
Right!
It's like, Natalie Portman isn't here because she made back her Bernie Madoff money. Like, she does not need to slum it anymore.
And they're so throwaway, like, they just had to make sure to address it. But I will say this, I really liked, my favorite part of the entire movie was Paul Bettany becoming Jarvis in, not the flesh, but sort of like in a Dr. Manhattan-ish way.
Vision. His name is Vision when he's that
thing. Vision. But he was super, I mean, he was sexy. I just felt like there was something very sexy and sexual about him. And so when he came onto the screen, I was excited about him, because usually I just have Ruffalo and Tony to sort of deal with. But then Ruffalo. But then Bruce was like going through some like weirdo where he's like being unavailable for like Scarlett Johansson's character, Black Widow. So he's like being unavailable and talking about like, I don't need all that. I want explosions. I want Scarlet Witch doing her little thing. Like she's literally like a Stevie Nicks or whatever she's doing. I need a lot of that.
If there's some Stevie Nicks in it, I'm down.
Isn't she Guy?
I want complex backstory and I want ladies with cool powers. all right, you guys. Well, we're all looking forward to even more adventure this summer. Are there, Margaret, you're our journalist, our respected journalist. What's on the horizon? What are we looking forward to movie-wise?
Oh, Jesus. You're putting this all on me?
I'm putting you on the spot. I'm sorry.
Jurassic World.
Jurassic World?
Entourage.
Entourage? Okay, oh. Winter's, oh, Winter's Entourage. Which stolen in here.
The four of us have to go see that guy. That's the deal.
Oh, Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible.
I'm down for that.
That's on.
I'm
down
for that. All right, Oliver, I am back for a week in June. If it comes out then, which I think it does, we're having a family trip to the movies.
Please. Oh, and can we? And you know what? Can we go to the iPick one? It's a little bit more, but it's totally worth
Where's it
for what
I pick
want.
One? What's
what
that?
Is it?
I don't know anything about this.
You can recline and get booze served to you.
Done.
That's exciting. You guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket, where we prefer to watch movies drunk. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Julie Sabatier, host of Rendered, a show about making meaning and breaking rules.
The thing about being a lawyer is we're really not supposed to encourage people to break the law.
Human beings have a superpower, and it's called play.
I love this carpet.
And your fingers dissect things just as well as anything does.
These stories are great to listen to while you're doing laundry, going for a run, cleaning your bathroom, or not sleeping on an airplane. Make boring stuff fun with Rendered, available now at MaximumFun.org or wherever you like to get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Over in the LA studio are...
Oliver Wang.
Margaret Wappler.
Oh, Winter Mitchell. Sorry, I'm drunk. Yeah.
Winter, every week on Pop Rocket, what's the question we all ask ourselves?
What's our jam?
Winter, what is your jam?
This is just, you know, this episode has been very emotional for me because I felt deeply about a lot of things and not interested in a lot of other things. So I want to talk about Mariah Carey. And she's just been getting trashed. And every time she has an album out, I'm sick of this being like her narrative, that an album comes out, she's going through a crisis, we must shit all over her and not let her just have a moment to do what she's great at.
What's the current crisis?
The current crisis is that she's divorced, you know, whatever his
her
name is.
Her dad manager.
Her dad. Nick Cannon. And then the Vegas show's not going well. She was sick.
The
she
dad manager was 10 years ago.
The dad mind. Manager. The yes. rehearsals at Billboard didn't happen and she wasn't as on the level that we need her to be. The woman has given us a lot. She's given us number one hits. She's given us, you know, all the excess and gravitas that you'd expect from from Long Island? She gets it. She knows what she's supposed to be here to do, and she doesn't try to be more than
that. She used to Stairmaster in heels on television.
Yes.
What more can we ask of this
she
woman?
She has a vented bedroom with a humidifier built in. I would kill for that. So her walk-in closet's the size of my bedroom.
She named her daughter after a fabric pattern.
Yes.
Wow, you guys have a lot of data. That you're just...
Her daughter's Glenn Platt or something?
Like... No.
Glenn Platt.
So she came out with a song called Number One to Infinity. It's actually called Infinity. The Number One to Infinity is just a collection of her number one hits. That's the album. And this song is called Infinity. And guess what? She's giving you Mariah. Stop hating. Just enjoy the song. And then L.A. Reid saying that she's not going to get a number one. Just... Don't kick a woman when she's down.
I'm ready.
She's ready. I should have actually had you start it from the very end where she just gives you like that octave like above dog whistle and is just...
I didn't think she could make that anymore. Even because the New York Times was saying in their review of her Vegas show, which was quite the takedown, they were like, she can't really make those notes anymore.
Even if it was a little bit of studio work, all that I'm getting out of my speaker is this, turn it up, because this is the part. No, that's not the part. So she just kind of, listen to the song for yourself. She knows what she's doing.
I'm with L.A. Reid.
I want a guy to like it.
I will take a proper listen, Winter, and I will report back next week. I love Mariah Carey, but I also live in a post-Ariana Grande world where
ooh.
She's leaving.
Oh, ouch.
Wow, this
ouch.
Is a hateful episode, man.
Oliver, Oliver, what's your jam?
We have The Rest is Noise, which is off of the new solo debut album by Jamie XX called In Color. So In Color just came out, or actually, I guess by the time this airs, it might not even be out yet. It will be coming out the next week. And I've never really sat with Jamie XX's production or remixes before, and I will give proper attribution here. You know, my friend Hua Su, who reviewed the album for New Yorker, had been raving about this album for weeks, and so I've kind of sat with it and took a listen to myself. And for someone who doesn't know a lot about Jamie XX, I like it a lot. There's all kinds of textures and kind of atmospheric qualities and ambient grooves, and Young Thug gets the cameo in here at one point. You know, it's supposedly kind of Jamie XX's look back to the rave culture of the 1990s in the UK, but in a way that's not overly nostalgic, but rather sort of taking some of those ideas and then bringing them forward. And I think for fans of his work in the past, and again, he's remixed a ton of stuff for a variety of artists, including Adele, and then the work, of course, he's did with the band The XX, I think this long-awaited debut is going to please many people. I'm pleased.
Oliver, between Jamie XX and Charlie XCX, is this a golden age for Roman numeral-based producers?
You know, we just finished the era of the era of the Zaz. You had RZA, you had Jizza, you had SZA, and I feel like there's some other MZA, LZA, something.
Right,
else.
After the Zs, we get
Roman numerals.
I just miss those days when somebody had to shout Pitbull's name or Red One at the beginning of a song to know that I liked it.
Last year.
Margaret, what's your jam?
My jam this week is Dream Lover by Destroyer, who's one of my favorites. He's coming out with an album. It's not even happening, this album, until August, but I got so excited by this new song. The album coming out is called Poison Season, and then the song is called Dream Lover. And the thing that I love about this song so much is that it's like the wheels might come off on this song any minute. It's just like high Springsteen, David Bowie like antics. So we're going to hear some of it right now.
Oh, this does feel retro.
Right?
It sounds 80s. It's 80s-ish too. No more vodka during Pop Rocket Podcast.
All vodka during the Pop Rocket Podcast.
Guy loves it.
Guy's jamming.
Yeah, no one's saying that What's Your Jam is a competition, but you won, Margaret.
All right. Thank you so much. Yeah, so I just love that there are horns in this and that it's messy and that the lyrics are like seductive and strange. It's just great. I really love Destroyer. If you haven't checked out his work before, he's Dan Bihar. He's done some things with the New Pornographers too, so definitely go and check it out.
Off of that very lovely song, let me remind everyone that this weekend is Memorial Day, which means that I will be officially opening the Guy Branum Summer Jam Search Committee.
Oh, yes.
So, please.
It's not Pretty Girls by Britney and Iggy at all.
Yes. Just keep your minds open. Keep your eyes open.
We need a sound effect when you talk about this. Yeah. There has to be like shooting stars kind of sound effect going on.
we'll snag something from California Girls.
Yeah.
My actual jam this week is not music because I'm me. and it's Jimmy Kimmel's tribute to David Letterman.
Ah.
I thought it was lovely. We're in a late night world where like things are screwed up and, you know, there's kind of bad blood in a lot of situations. And we weren't in a world where Letterman, I feel bad for Stephen Colbert because Letterman's been kind of pissy about not being consulted about who's going to succeed him.
Interesting.
And what, Oliver?
I think he's been very politic about it. I mean, he's basically said, and not in a way that to me seemed like he was pissy or judgmental about it. I had nothing to do with it.
But I would have liked to see a woman or a person.
Right.
Of color.
But it didn't sound like to me he was throwing, it didn't sound like to me that he was criticizing the choice, but he's making it very clear this was not my doing.
Yeah.
I felt a little bad for Stephen Colbert, but I thought it was so amazing that Jimmy Kimmel was so open and upfront about saying, this is the guy who made me love what I'm doing. And seeing a tribute like that come from another network, I thought was interesting and lovely.
Touching.
And I was glad that somebody did it because both Letterman and Conan got so unceremoniously thrown out of various places at various times that, like, somebody giving them some respect. And also of the sort we did not see for Leno, because Leno's a dickbag.
Truth. You are truthing, guy.
Hit it, Rockapella.
It was like he had one of those tiny-sized screwdrivers you use on eyeglasses, and he was always just gently twisting a little screw all the time. And I loved it. I started drawing pictures of Dave on the covers of my textbooks at school. When I turned 16, we have a picture. Well, that's my Aunt Chippy. My mother baked me a late night with David Letterman cake. And you can see I'm wearing a Dave Letterman jacket. My first car, I went to the DMV and I got a late night vanity plate. That's my little brother wearing jams. He still wears them, by the way. We had no VCR, so I'd have late night with David Letterman viewing parties at my house in the middle of the night. My friends, who also loved the show, Cleta was one of them, would come over at midnight. My parents would be asleep, and we'd drink soda and watch the show. Looking back, I've now figured out why none of the girls at school wanted to have sex with me. I watched the show every night. I never missed it. And little did I know that many years and many pounds later, that watching the show was a great education for me. I learned almost nothing in college. I really did. But watching late night, not only did I learn how to do everything from Dave, the reason I have this show is because the executives at ABC saw me when I was a guest on Dave's show and hired me to host this show. So I want to thank Dave and his writers and producers.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell,
Margaret
Poplar, and Oliver Way.
I like the new sign-off.
Right, that's the way to snazz up the ending.
Good to talk to you.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Toronathan, Kraz, Seattle Fan Cora, Sahiba C, Jamie Klein Daly, Layman DC, Abraham Drimmer, L. Joysek, Paul Sievis. Oh, Paul is my friend. Thank you, Paul. Spankmo, M. Lyman, Shelar, Writer Texas, Julie D. 2377, and Emma Jane P. 17. Those sound like, to me, they just sound like robot 17-year-old girls.
Yes.
For the 5-star reviews on iTunes, if you haven't already, please review us. Follow us on Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Also, why don't we all just remind everybody one more time what all of our Twitter handles are so they can follow us as people.
At Queen, K-W-E-E-N, everything. Queen everything.
At Margaret Wappler, W-A-P-P-L-E-R.
I switched it up a few months ago. I am now at Oliver S. Wang.
Like a person, Oliver.
I know.
And I'm at Guy Branum. Join our Facebook group and tell us what's something you love by an artist you loathe. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is Colin Anderson, whom we miss very much.
Very
and
much. Jennifer,
Godspeed.
And Jennifer Marmor, who we love even though she's here.
We love them both.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.